Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. I just read that Rwanda filed at the ITU for 330,000 satellites. Yes, you heard right, 330 with three additional zeros. As you can imagine, the announcement drew some serious comment traffic on the internet, to say the least. But hey, this, I have the feeling, is not going to be the end, but rather a beginning of something. But where is all this going to lead? As small as modern satellites may be, the sky is big, but at some point, it's not big enough. Two worlds collide. On the one hand, the astronomers want an undisturbed view upwards. In turn, there are others who pursue promising business interests and see the future in constellations, making our lives easier, better, faster, and the usual superlatives, you know. And in between, there is no judge and no police to offer clear guidelines. It seems we could use a little good advice here. Our guest today calls both worlds his home.
Thank you. Actually, there's just one more prep that I just wanted to do, and that was just to tell my wife that I'm starting.
Andrew Williams works for the European Southern Observatory in Chile, where they are currently working on the ELT, the Extremely Large Telescope, the world's largest once it's finished. He represents ESO.
And my job involves dealing with relations with our member states.
So, are constellations good or bad? And does terrestrial astronomy have a future? Let's roll, everyone. The European Southern Observatory has an aura of an exotic and romantic and mysterious place, that is. Is it mysterious? Is it exotic?
Yes, so I guess I think that astronomers may like to think of themselves as exotic and a bit romantic, spending their professional lives gazing at the stars.
Flat on their backs all night gazing at the stars, yes. Right?
ESO, the European Southern Observatory. So we are an intergovernmental organization. So we have the same type of status as the European Space Agency. And we were founded actually a long time ago, almost 60 years ago, when a group of astronomers from five European countries came together and wanted to increase the capacity of European astronomy. And they decided to build an observatory in the Southern Hemisphere, because at the time, the competitor facilities were mainly in the Northern Hemisphere in the United States. So to be competitive, it was a good idea to go to the South, because you see a different part of the sky. And our mission is to develop and operate world-leading astronomical observatories and foster cooperation in astronomy. And we operate a suite of world-leading telescopes in three separate sites in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And this place, well, it's high, which is good for observing. So there's less atmosphere in front of your telescope. It's very dry. That's also good for observing. There's a very supportive government in Chile who really prioritizes the science of astronomy and puts a lot of effort into its facilities and support for all the different observatories that are there. And it's also a very nice place.
And is it a good place to spend several, I don't know, weeks or months? Because I imagine that to be a very lonely place to work at. Because, I mean, like, there's no, I guess, no entertainment and no football and no nothing than work.
It's very remote. And the reason why is because we want to be far away from light pollution from the cities. But ESO does a pretty good job of making the staff feel comfortable there. So one of the problems with the Atacama Desert, which is actually a benefit for astronomy, is that it has very low humidity. So it actually can make you feel a bit uncomfortable being at high altitude for a long time in low humidity. So the ESO facility has a very nice swimming pool and with some tropical palm trees around. The staff can take a swim, but also it serves another function, which is to increase the humidity inside the building.
How long do people actually work at this place on a complete stretch? So would that be like several months or several weeks?
I think it depends on the particular role that you're doing. But for most of the astronomers, they usually spend a two-week stretch. So these are the astronomers that actually operate the telescopes. And usually a lot of the observations are done remotely. So astronomers around the world submit a request, and then the telescope is actually controlled by the astronomers on the site. And they usually do two-week shifts. So 2 weeks on and then 2 weeks rest.
So is it more... So you're saying astronomers are on site, but is it more an engineering task to handle the hardware and to handle the telescopes? Because the actual observation and the data that is coming out of the telescope is being analyzed all over the place, all over the globe. So is it, do you, if I wanted to apply it for the, for a job, would I need to be an engineer or an astronomer?
You can be both, or one or the other. And actually, I believe actually that engineers are the largest staff complement at the moment. And one of the reasons for this is because we are currently constructing the extremely large telescope, which is a really large project, 1.3 billion euro budget. So we have the need for a lot of engineers at the moment. And the ELT is going to be the largest ever optical ground-based telescope ever constructed.
Wow. Wow. We're seeing, hopefully, very soon, the launch of the James Webb Telescope. So people may have heard of that telescope. That one is going into space. The ELT is on Earth. What's the difference between the two?
So the, well, to answer your question about the operation, the current first light date is so-called, is planned for 2027. So still 6 or 7 years to wait, but it's making really good progress. And the ELT will have a very large main mirror. So it's going to be a 39-meter main mirror. The James Webb telescope is, I think, something like 6 or 7 meters once it unfolds in space. So this is a very big mirror. So currently the next biggest mirror on a telescope is the Grand Tican telescope in La Palma. And this is 10.4 meters. Or maybe you could count the large binocular telescope in Arizona, which actually is 2 8-meter mirrors side by side. So the ELT is a little bit different that the you can't build a mirror that is 39 meters with a single piece of glass, because as soon as you try to put it in the structure, it would sag due to the force of gravity, or it would probably break. So what you do is you build it out of hexagonal segments. So there's going to be 798 of these meter size hexagonal segments in this telescope. And then there are 4 other smaller mirrors that perform the adaptive optics to correct for the atmospheric distortion and guide and focus the light onto the different instruments in the telescope. And of course, that's one of the differences that we have to do with ground-based astronomy, is we have to try and correct for the atmospheric distortion, whereas if you have your telescope in space, you don't have to worry about that so much. But some really amazing engineering that is going into this telescope. One pretty cool fact, I think, is that in order for the optics to work, you have to have the surface of this mirror really smooth within nanometers. So if you think about having a smoothness of nanometers over 39 meters, this is equivalent to having something the size of the Pacific Ocean, where the biggest bump is about the size of a football. So this is the type of engineering that's going into it. And they have to keep all these 798 segments in perfect alignment in order to make the optics work. So there's sort of amazing work going on in the edge sensors between each segment and the laser control surfaces. And yeah, it's really amazing. Now, of course, the James Webb Space Telescope has its own challenges because they have to unfurl this quite big mirror in space. And that's also very amazing. This type of telescope has its own particular science case. There's, for astronomers, there's many different factors that go into the design of a telescope, but a really important one is the size of the mirror. So a bigger mirror allows you to collect more light in a shorter amount of time. So if you imagine trying to collect rain, if you wanted to collect as much rain as possible, you would have a very big bucket. And then the rain analogy breaks down. The benefit of having a big mirror is that you can resolve finer details. ELT, because it has this giant mirror, it's going to be the biggest mirror in the world on the ground. It's really going to revolutionize science and things like actually being able to image planets outside of our solar system, so around stars other than our own sun. So this is something that's really amazing.
Fascinating. Is there like an analogy? Could you, with that telescope, if I looked into it, and could I don't know, see something on the moon, like a detail on the moon?
So I think...
If it were to be directed at the moon in the first place.
So I believe you could resolve a detail of about 5 to 10 meters size. So you wouldn't be able to see the Apollo moon landings really, but you could see some pretty amazing detail.
Fascinating.
And this is just the size of the mirror. Now, I'm not actually sure you could open the aperture pointing at the moon, because the moon is very bright and it might cause some damage to the detectors. So I'd have to ask one of my astronomer colleagues about that. But in theory,
fascinating.
Yeah, you could resolve that sort of detail.
By the way, Andy, how did you end up working with ESO?
So I started out life wanting to be a doctor, and then I...
Like a medical doctor.
Like a medical doctor. And then through some chance occurrences, I found physics and astronomy, and I studied for physics and astronomy. I was thinking about doing a PhD, and the subject that I wanted to do required a lot of mathematics. So I had this great idea, I'll take a year off and I'll get a job and I'll study the required maths in my spare time. And of course, not many people in their right mind would actually study algebraic topology and quantum gravity mathematics in their spare time. So the idea of this PhD abandoned, and I was working for the Ministry of Defence in the UK on some kind of space-related aspects, which I can't really talk about. But I was always, I always had in my mind that I wanted to work for the space and astronomy world. So after a couple of years, I applied to look for another job. And again, I looked at the European Space Agency, I looked at CERN, I looked at ESO. There was nothing available. And I found a job in NATO in the United States. And again, there was a connection there. That it was about communications and technology, and there was a potential to work on some space topics. So I thought, okay. But then a little diversion happened. And as it often happens in the military, the boss said, oh, we need some people to think about how to collaborate and jointly plan with UN agencies and NGOs in conflict zones. And I found myself working on this project and realized that physics and astronomy wasn't really helpful. So I ended up enrolling on a PhD program in public policy. And this gained me the organization studies and policy analysis that I needed for this work problem. I was able to do a minor in international relations and conflict resolution. And then this really transformed my career into something completely different than what I originally thought I was going to do, which was a more technical field. And I ended up heading up a policy studies team and working on some very challenging problems, which required transdisciplinary thinking, working with teams of engineers and soldiers and technologists and lawyers.
What kind of problems?
So this is questions like, what do we do about private military security companies? What should NATO do about autonomous systems in conflict zones? And there was always this theme about how new technologies and capabilities stretch the existing governance system and laws. And to understand this, you need to have multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary thinking. And of course, this is a nod to one of the current problems that we're facing in the astronomy world about satellite constellations. But To cut a long story short, all this time I was at NATO, I wasn't going home at night and reading about defense and war. I was reading about space and astronomy. And eventually I thought, okay, it's time for a change. And the job came up at ESO. It was external relations. And this sort of combined my two interests, my kind of policy analysis and international relations theme with my love of. And now I found myself, as I said, dealing with our relations with our member states, working on some high-level policies for the organization, and representing us in various forums, including COPUS.
Can you explain what COPUS is?
So this is, it's one of the subcommittees of the UN General Assembly, in effect, and it's the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space that deals with the international governance of outer space. And this was
fascinating,
particularly in the light of the satellite constellation challenge.
You have a pretty fascinating biography to offer. I mean, like, you were all set for any kind of challenge, professional challenge coming up, because you have done it all. You've seen it all. So bring it on.
So, you know, one of the really nice things that I've been doing recently is getting involved in some mentoring schemes for people in the space sector. And there's sort of two things I say. The first one is that ask people for help and advice. You know, this was something that I never did in the start of my career. And this is how I ended up with this meandering approach. Okay, I don't regret that, but that's how it was. And then the second thing is that don't worry too much if you can't get into the space sector directly at first. Find ways to keep awareness and knowledge and gain transferable experiences, because the space sector is very diverse and there's many different roles and they're calling out for people with different kinds of experiences. So don't worry too much if you don't get a job straight away. It took me almost 15 years to end up where I wanted.
There must be a shortcut. So do you still mentor, and how do people, if they're interested, get hold of your mentoring skills? Can they call you?
I think that we have this wonderful thing called social media now, which actually, when I started out, just wasn't around. It didn't even exist. You can find almost anybody on LinkedIn. So I'm on LinkedIn, and anybody is welcome to contact me and ask me a question. And the worst that I will say is, I'm sorry, I don't have time to help you at the moment. And I really do my best to help people if they ask me any question. And that's just nice. From my own kind of experience of being without guidance for a long time. And I realize how important it is. So that's one way. And then the other way, that there's a couple of mentoring programs that are in existence, and I try my best to participate in these where possible.
Nice. So you, people would find you under Dr. Andy Williams on LinkedIn, or Andrew Williams.
Yeah, unfortunately, Andy Williams is a very common name. So I think there's tens of thousands of us, but I think if you search for Andy Williams, and it will usually come up.
So, all right. Nice. Andy, you mentioned a pretty important term, and that is constellation these days. And I think this is one of your passion projects, I should say. And this is all about, like, I have the feeling that constellations are the thing for ever since Elon Musk's Starlink started to circle the Earth and be visible to anyone out there. Now, anyone wants its own or their own constellation. So I guess that you're referring to an upcoming problem that we're experiencing down here on the Earth. Is that right? And that problem needs a solution, of course.
Yes. So the satellite constellation issue, I mean, I think many people in the space sector are aware of this, mainly from the space debris problem, but it has an impact on Earth. Let's just establish what we're talking about here, right? So by satellite constellation, we mean a number of similar satellites of similar type and function in similar and complementary orbits operating for a shared purpose and usually under shared control. So examples of this would be the GPS systems like Galileo and GLONASS. And we've got a satellite constellation for satellite telephone, the Iridium constellation, for example. You can do Earth observation constellations. So there's a fantastic company called Planet Labs, which has quite a large constellation. And the new thing is to have a satellite broadband internet. and also the Internet of Things to try and connect machines and systems together directly. And the important factor, in addition to having broadband internet, is the signal latency, the time it takes for the signals to go from ground up to the satellite and then back down to another user on Earth. And we already have broadband internet from space. These are satellites in the geostationary region. But the issue with that is that they are 36,000 kilometers away, I think, if I recall correctly. And it takes a couple of seconds for the signal to travel. My family live in a remote area in Virginia. And sometimes when you're trying to have a video call with them, it's problematic because there's several seconds of delay and it's not very nice. So if you lower all the satellites to very low altitudes, just a couple of hundred kilometers, you drastically reduce this time. And this has many positive benefits for life on Earth. So you can have high quality internet all over the world. That's true. But there's a big but. We will have thousands of satellites overhead at any one time. And this is going to cause an impact on ground-based astronomy and actually even space-based astronomy to some extent. The Hubble Space Telescope is below the altitude of some of these constellations, and that will also be affected. So my current concern, I'm not sure I'd call it a passion, as you said, but my one of my main projects at the moment is working on this issue and trying to coordinate it at ESO, working with the astronomy community more broadly. So we have a lot of various projects ongoing to try and study the issue, to try and work with industry, and to try and convince governments to actually do something about it and protect astronomy.
What caught my attention immediately is when I did a little bit of research about your work is that on the ESO blog, I found a section where now Andrew Williams and Juliana Rotola are implementing a new idea to protect our view of the stars. So you have all my attention. So what is the new idea you're proposing?
So this is, I mean, we have to put this in context that there's a lot of activities that are ongoing. We're working directly with industry, and I can certainly tell you more about that. We're doing simulations, we're doing observations of the satellites ourselves. We are working in national working groups, so with the American Astronomical Society, the Royal Astronomical Society in the UK, the European Astronomical Society, and many others. And we're trying to make links with government representatives in the space regulatory authorities, let's say. And then there's also the international sector. So we have some projects, the Dark and Quiet Skies project, which is addressing COPUS, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And as part of all this, another idea is that you can consider astronomy actually as a space activity. So if you look at the Outer Space Treaty, which is a treaty now ratified by, I think, just over 100 countries. And it's like an international charter for behavior in outer space. And it defines, or it talks about how governments should with space activities, but it actually doesn't specifically define what a space activity is. And the work that I did with Juliana was to just ask a theoretical question and, you know, say, well, is astronomy, even if it's taking place from the ground, can we consider this a space activity under the Outer Space Treaty? And if you just take a cursory look at the Outer Space Treaty, it refers to the freedom of scientific investigation, the exploration and use of outer space. And of course, astronomy is literally the exploration of outer space from the ground. So it's the original science of space exploration. It's exploration of space for peaceful purposes. So this is a theme that's in the Outer Space Treaty. And it's something that benefits humankind uniformly. It takes place without discrimination and for the benefit of all countries. So again, this is a language that's in the Outer Space Treaty. And you can come up with many examples of space exploration being partially dependent on astronomical observations. For example, when a space agency is sending out a probe to visit a comet or an asteroid, you know, usually this requires extensive astronomical observations to make sure that you can interpret the results scientifically. You can determine the precise location that the precise trajectory that the spacecraft needs to travel. For example, we had this idea that you can actually consider astronomy as a space activity and invoke some kind of protection of it under the Outer Space Treaty. Now, it's a theoretical idea. It doesn't actually have much practical meaning because it still requires the states to actually take action and implement the articles in the Outer Space Treaty.
So that means once that proper terminology is found, and that astronomy is such an activity, then that would invoke and produce a couple of consequences. That is, you cannot bring harm, in my layperson's terms, to astronomy because it is an activity. Is that something you as a professional could live with? Am I understanding those things right?
So the Outer Space Treaty, in a nutshell, it sets the expectation for transparency, for coordination, consultation, in order to avoid harmful interference and to conduct space activities with due regard to others. Now, our idea was is that if you consider astronomy as a space activity, you somehow invoke this obligation to consult with the astronomy community. Now, how that's actually implemented in practice is another question. First step is to establish this as an obligation.
What is actually at the moment going on in space when it comes to constellations? So am I understanding things right that constellations are getting ever more attention by different parties like telecoms and whatnot, because they have certain benefits, as you explained already? So are we experiencing the onset of a constellation issue, or are we in the middle of it already?
So I think we're still at the relatively early days. There are several projects underway. So we have SpaceX Starlink project, which has the most number of satellites launched already. So I think they're launching all the time, so it's hard to keep track, but I think they're over 1,000 satellites now. And then we have OneWeb Constellation, which is this company which kind of almost went bankrupt and then was rescued by the UK government. And so is now plowing ahead full steam, and they are launching, and they are looking likely to complete their full complement, their first phase of 700 satellites. And then we have several other projects in development. So there's one by Amazon Kuiper, it's called. And there's a project called Telsat, which has received funding from the Canadian government. And then we
Do you know what Amazon is planning with that constellation?
Yeah, so the Kuiper one, it's similar to the Starlink, a similar idea to provide broadband internet. And they are operating actually at a roughly similar altitude, so quite low, as are the Starlinks.
Will we all very soon have our internet connection via those constellations? So will terrestrial internet be or soon be outdated?
That's a good question. And there are different ways to get internet. You can have a fiber optic broadband cable. You can have a cellular phone and LTE signal. You can have satellites. You can have high altitude balloons in the atmosphere. It remains to be seen whether all these different companies can actually compete in the real marketplace or whether they will depend on government backing. We have companies like SpaceX and Amazon have their own sources of capital, let's say. So they're very well financed. And then but other companies have quite substantial backing from governments. Traditionally, in the space sector, we see quite a high attrition rate for such projects that they tend to, you know, either not get off the ground fully or they go bankrupt. So, yeah, it could be the case that only a few of these projects will actually survive, but we don't know. But from the astronomy perspective, we can only go on what is officially reported. So we can't speculate on whether or not a company is going to fail. And what is officially reported is what's filed with the national communications regulators and submitted to the International Telecommunications Union, which gets the frequency assignments for these constellations. And this gives us an indication that has applied for 40,000 or so satellites. Amazon Kuiper is, I think it's 4,000 or 5,000. OneWeb is 6,000 or 7,000. There's a Chinese project which has a filing at the IT, something like 13,000.
13?
Yeah. So we are, when understanding the impacts on astronomy, we are working on the assumption usually between 60,000 to 100,000 constellation satellites out there. And this is just taking the main projects, so Starlink, OneWeb, Kuiper, and the Chinese project. So assuming that all those proceed, there'll be 60,000 plus satellites in the sky. And this will cause us some headaches, for sure.
Absolutely. And darker skies, I guess. So what is the average lifespan of such a satellite within the constellation, that is?
Yeah, so it depends. I know that the kind of expected lifetime of the Starlinks is about 5 years. When you think, okay, they have thousands and thousands of objects, they need to have a continual launch to replenish them.
So what if their lifespan is over? What happens to a typical satellite, solar satellite?
So one of the justifications, in addition to the latency of the signal, one of the justifications of being in low Earth orbit is that when the satellite goes out of service, it will deorbit more rapidly and will just burn up in the atmosphere.
That's what Amazon Starlink says, I guess. So, but will they really deorbit, or is this just theory?
So they, I understand that they are working on safe deorbiting mechanisms, so such that when the satellite ends its lifetime, it can basically deorbit itself under control. But of course, this doesn't always happen. So there are instances where a satellite is tumbling, but because of friction of the atmosphere, even at this altitude, they will deorbit fairly rapidly within the course of the year. So, okay, not so much of a problem from that perspective. But then there's some projects which are at higher altitudes, and this is a bit of a problem, because once you get over and you're looking at a kind of natural decay rate of in the order of 2,000 years, so you'll have defunct satellites floating around there for quite some time. And this is a problem when you have thousands of them.
Let's just, Andy, make a quick thought experiment. So suppose I have the necessary funds and I wanted to launch my own Marcus constellation. Because I like it. So what would I need to do? Who would I have to ask for permission? Do I have to ask for permission? So my constellation, let's just make this up. I have a launcher who will bring my CubeSats, my constellation satellites, into orbit. I will not make sure that they have the orbiting mechanisms built in, because that's too expensive. And I want them highly reflective so I can see them from my backyard. And who would have anything to say against this? Or would I have to ask anyone in the first place what I wanted to do here?
So that's a good question. And I think it reveals that we have an issue. So the first thing you would do, assuming that you wanted to at least get some data from these satellites or control them in some kind of way, you would have to file for a frequency assignment via the International Telecommunications Union, which is an intergovernmental organization that deals with the global management of radio frequency assignments, including in space. Now, the typical way to do this is you would go to a national administration and work through them, and they would submit the application for you. Now,
but that's just paperwork.
It depends on the country. So some countries use that step as a way to check and to make sure that your project meets certain conditions. So in the US, you have to go through the Federal Communications Commission in order to get your frequencies from the ITU. And the Federal Communications Commission will make you jump through certain regulatory loops, such as doing an assessment on space debris and looking at the interference that the frequencies that you want might have on other systems. So once that's done, the only other step that you would have to do is get a launch license. And again, this depends on the state that you choose to launch your rockets from. A state like the US, I believe the Federal Aviation Administration does do a cursory payload review, and where they, you know, check for hazardous materials, but other countries do different things. And there is no stage that checks for the visual appearance. So you can make your satellites as reflective as you want. You can make them line up and spell a word or display a giant sign in in space, except if you do that through the US, because the US is the only country in the world, as far as we know, that actually has a law against that. So you would just go to some other country. And this
to write markers in the sky.
You could, in theory, do that. You could,
nice.
In theory, could have a bag of ball bearings on your payload. And you find a country that doesn't do a payload review, and you could just launch these ball bearings into space without too much problem. Now, of course, this would be an absolutely crazy thing to do. So I don't think that many serious space actors would actually attempt to do that. But from the visual brightness aspect, this is one of the issues that we're dealing with, is that there's no regulatory step at all that kind of takes care of that. And that's one of the things that we're trying to work on at the moment.
All right. I see that the main bottleneck is the frequency question, because without that frequency, I wouldn't be able to communicate with my gear in space. So I couldn't hijack that system and reroute my strategy without any green light from those authorities you just mentioned. Because I was just wondering, if I didn't take care of all of this you just mentioned, who would get in trouble? Would NATO invade my country and then do something to stop me? Or who would get in trouble? Would my country get in trouble because I'm a citizen of a country, or would I get in trouble by who? So who would stop me from doing this?
So this is one of the interesting things about the current system of, let's say, space governance. So the nature of the Outer Space Treaty, it means that states are liable for activities of their own national agencies, and also private companies that are registered with that state. So in order to make a claim for damage, you would have to convince to take this up. And this is this is different to other sectors, you know, such as the nuclear industry or the oil industry, where there are international treaties established under a regime of civil liability, which means that this means that operators can be liable for damages. And this is actually defined in the treaty to some extent. In answer to your question, there's nothing much that anyone could do other than a state effectively making a diplomatic claim or taking another state to court in an international court. That's currently the only kind of mechanism to deal with that.
And of course, then my state would send the police.
I suppose if your state had specific rules on that, then they could come and fine you.
Knock on my door.
Or arrest you, yeah. But the overall regulatory landscape on this matter is, I think, a bit patchy. So some states are more strict than others in these types of issues.
When will we have a clear space regulation for all kinds of questions Will there be any solution anytime soon?
So I know from having spent some time in Copuus, there are many ongoing discussions, you know, about the long-term sustainability of outer space, the problem of space debris, and now the problem of the impact on astronomy. And there are a lot of people thinking about all these problems, but the way the international system works is that it takes a lot of time to solve these problems in a comprehensive and agreed way. Now, all this is happening, the companies are still launching thousands of satellites. And this is actually because the rules of the International Telecommunications Union state that they have to bring their systems into operation within a certain time frame. I think it's 7 years. Otherwise, they lose the frequency assignments. In order to halt the progress of the deployment of satellite constellations, in order to allow a global rule system to be figured out, we would also have to address the whole system of the ITU. So that's another complication to all that.
So, I mean, like, this sounds like a dead end where we have maneuvered ourselves into. Am I exaggerating?
I don't think it's a dead end, but I think that it's a very complex and it's a very politically challenging problem. And I think that there's a certain type of incrementalism going on where countries are fully aware of the dangers of filling space with tens of thousands of satellites all crammed together in low Earth orbit. And there's certain movements underway to try and create, you know, principles for responsible space behavior, for example. Mm-hmm. There's some, you know, efforts to try and create some kind of guidance against doing anti-satellite missile tests in space, for example. And we have an international movement to try and get governments and companies to take account of the night sky as well.
Absolutely. So, talking about those, by the way, the first time I saw the Starlink constellation, which was a absolutely mind-blowing and fascinating moment because I wasn't ready for that to, I mean, like, that looked like an alien invasion, like 5 minutes of constant movement, perfectly aligned on the night sky. And that I think that was in spring, and I haven't seen any ever since. So has Elon Musk, as announced, taken care of the reflectivity issue? So has anything changed ever since, or is it just me not watching the night sky at the appropriate times?
So there's several aspects here. So yeah, you're right. When the Starlinks were first launched back in 2019, they were super bright. And you could see them even in a very well, so it was quite spectacular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, since we've been working with SpaceX on this problem, they have taken some steps.
Not the ones in orbit, but the ones to be launched. So they can't repaint them while they're in orbit.
Yeah, so the ones that are already there, it's too late. But they made an experiment called the DarkSat, and they painted, it was the antennas, which are on the bottom surface of the satellite, which were white, so very reflective, and they tried painting them black. But this, unfortunately, had the problem that it made the satellite heat up and the electronics went bad. So they abandoned that, and they tried another thing, which was called VisorSat. And this is basically, they make a sunshade that deploys after launch, and this prevents the sun from reflecting from the bottom of the spacecraft that's facing Earth. And then they made another change, which was operational change. So during the orbit raise, they launch and they release the satellites around 300 kilometers, and then they have a period where they raise them up to the operational altitude. And I think the reason why they do that is that they check each satellite to make sure that it's functioning properly. If it's not functioning, then because it's at 300 kilometers, will decay very quickly. So that's good space sustainability practice, let's say. Now, nice. It used to be that, well, the solar panel isn't deployed during this operational raise because there's too much drag from the atmosphere. The solar panel is a meter flat solar panel. And this was a super bright thing that's facing down to Earth. So all they did is they just turned the satellites like a kind of knife edge going through the atmosphere mm-hmm. so that you don't see as much.
You don't see it anymore.
Yeah. Now, under certain observing conditions, depending on the geometry of the sun and the observer, you can still see them, but it's definitely less than it was before. So mm-hmm. this is a good thing. And we, as in the astronomy community, defined a limit of brightness that we were hoping, that's called mm-hmm. a visual magnitude, and a number which was 7. And this actually corresponds to the limit of what you can see with your unaided eye in a very dark site. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this was the goal that they were trying to reach. And we've been doing observations of hundreds of satellites with a range of telescopes around the world. And they definitely have darkened them from the first set of satellites that were launched. So they're at an average of about 6.5, but there's a wide variation. So, you know, a large fraction of the satellites are still fairly bright. And this is just because mm-hmm. of the geometry. It just depends where the sun is and where mm-hmm. you are and exactly what's happening with the satellite. So there's still work mm-hmm. to do. But to the credit of SpaceX, they really put a lot of effort and thought into this and in a mm-hmm. way have set a sort of best practice. But SpaceX are a kind of unique company in that they control almost their entire end-to-end from the design to the manufacturing to the launch. Mm-hmm. And they build all the components themselves. And they build the satellites and they build the launches. So it's fairly easy for them to control and conduct these types of experiments. Whereas other companies, they do a lot of contracting out and they buy different parts from suppliers and have a big consortium. So it's much harder to do these iterative design changes. So mm-hmm. we are in discussion with people from Amazon and engineers from OneWeb and a few others about potential design changes that they could make, but it's mm-hmm. very early stages at the moment.
Andy, our constellations, they are useful, as we heard, because they bring the internet and other benefits to Earth, but they are annoying from a visual perspective. But do they also have additional issues that come with constellations? Do they interfere, I don't know, with other pieces of hardware we already have in orbit?
So there's a general concern about radio interference. Now, in mm-hmm. theory, this is managed by the ITU, and they assign different frequency bands to different systems. And in theory, any interference problems, in order to get the assignment, they have to show that they've gone through a process of coordination with other systems that are operating in the same frequency zone, and they resolve it. And the operators or the governments in some cases work together and they resolve the interference problem and then move forward. Now, for the case of the astronomers, it's a little bit different. Radio astronomers, we have actually secured some limited bands of the radio spectrum for use only for radio astronomy. So that means that operators aren't allowed to transmit in these frequency bands. So it's a very small mm-hmm. amount. It's about 1-2% of the spectrum below 86 mm-hmm. gigahertz, I think. Now, science still happens outside of these protected bands. So mm-hmm. cosmic objects emit across the entire spectrum. So radio observatories still like to observe outside of these very narrow protected bands. So how do they do this? They find a very remote area on Earth. They negotiate with the local government to try and protect the frequency range within a certain radio quiet zone. And this is happening in countries like South Africa and Australia. So a new astronomy project called the Square Kilometre Array Observatory is starting. It's a new radio telescope. And part of the case that South Africa and Australia made to host the observatory rested on their ability to protect the spectrum for this observatory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the change that's happening is that before, the observatories just had to worry about people using a cell phone nearby or TV signals. But now there will be thousands of satellites overhead at any time. From the perspective of the visual interference, at any given time, there's large fractions of the constellation above the local horizon that are not illuminated by the sun. It doesn't matter. They're just there as dark objects that you can't detect with a telescope. But from the perspective of a radio observatory, these satellites, thousands of satellites, so I think the mm-hmm. figure from ESO Paranal, assuming the full Starlink OneWeb Wang constellations, it's something like 3,000 to 5,000 satellites overhead at any one time. So that's a lot.
Like right now. So above me right now.
Not right now, because Starlink and Guowang, and they haven't launched their full constellations. Yeah. But you know, if the full deployment happens, there will be thousands of satellites overhead at any one time, and presumably they'll be transmitting. But for a radio observatory, every single degree of the sky will be filled with an object.
Sure.
And the way that radio quiet zones are set up is that they don't offer any protection from space-based transmissions. So there's several types of issues. So the first thing is that a satellite can beam down directly into an observatory, and actually it can cause, in the case of certain radio observatories, so that's something that you don't want. And then the second issue is that radio observatories are usually really sensitive. They can detect signals that are hundreds of millions of times fainter than a cell phone, and they can detect the leakage out the side of these antennas on the satellites, called the side load. The antennas that and the operators, they try and concentrate all the energy in one direction, but you can never really do that. There's always some kind of leakage out the back, and radio observatories can detect this from the thousands of objects. And then the other issue is that there's going to be thousands of objects with operating electronics, and it's just going to create electronic noise in certain frequencies. And there's standards for this on Earth. Your TV or your computer monitor has certain electronic noise standards so that it doesn't interfere with your, you know, your doorbell or your cell phone. But in space, there's no real kind of globally accepted standards on this. So that's another issue. So this is a big problem for radio observatories. And I think actually in many ways, it's more problematic than the optical case, which is, it depends on the time of day and or the time of night, I should say. It depends where you are, and it depends on the type of telescope that you have. So for the case of a narrow field telescope that's looking at a tiny portion of the sky, it's not really a big problem. Whereas for the telescopes that see very large sections of the sky at once, it is a big problem. So this is something that we're also thinking about with the whole business of radio frequency spectrum management at the ITU and trying to deal with this satellite constellation issue.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Absolutely. So what job descriptions are needed most in the future? So who should apply for what kind of job? Because I think that the challenges are huge, and those challenges need the smartest people we can find and come up with. So who is needed?
I think that in the astronomy world, we need to devote a bit more effort to industry liaison, to spectrum management. And there's a sort of issue at the moment is that these aren't really seen as attractive career choices for people, because astronomers, surprisingly, they want to do science and study the sky. So there is the International Astronomical Union has actually created a concept for a new center, the Center for Protection of the Dark Skies Against Satellite Constellations. It's its tentative name, and there's some proposals under review at the moment. And this center will try and consolidate various types of expertise with industry, dealing with policy and regulation, and then dealing with all the astronomy concerns, which can be dealt with by astronomers. So that's on the astronomy side. And then I think on the government side, one thing that we see is that would be really nice to have some astronomers involved in the various regulatory agencies, the various governance boards that are overseeing space economies and space sectors. So many different challenges to think about here.
Wonderful. Andy, unfortunately, we have come to the end of our beautiful conversation. But there's one more thing I'd love to ask you. And as this is a Space Cafe podcast, a coffee place, espresso is served in this coffee place. And usually an espresso is something to stimulate your mind and your body, give you a little boost of energy. So why don't you give us a boost of energy and inspiration for the mind now with whatever topic you would like to choose. So think of it as an espresso for the mind.
So
that would leave our audience refreshed, energized, and inspired. And go ahead.
I love espresso, but I'm actually more of a latte man. So maybe I can give you, so here's the espresso. And I think that some advice for the listeners, you should plan a trip. So find a night without a full moon, without cloud, and take a trip away from the city. And as far as you can get away from the city, as late at night as possible, at least several hours after sunset, and go out and lie on your back and look at the sky, wait 30 minutes for your eyes to be fully adjusted, and just marvel at the thousands and thousands of stars that you will see, and the arc of the Milky Way slowly rotating, the occasional shooting star, the occasional satellite, hopefully not too many. And now here's the latte part. Think that the majority of those stars have at least one planet going around them. And imagine that these stars you can see are just a drop in the bucket of the 100 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy alone. And all of these likely have planets. And now imagine that our Milky Way galaxy is just one of the trillion or so galaxies in the entire universe. So that's 200 billion trillion stars. That's two with 23 zeros after it. And there's probably the same number of planets. And trillions of these planets will be in the habitable zone around the star where life could exist. And then think, is there life out there in the universe? And the thing is that all these stars, even in our near neighborhood, solar neighborhood, they are achingly and agonizingly far away that we can't go there. It's just not possible in our lifetimes and probably never, due to the limitations of the speed of light. So we'll never be able to visit them in person. So the only means that we have to explore and search for life is through astronomy.
Maybe when after going through that process you just mentioned and beautifully described, one could end by asking oneself, am I really the smartest person in the universe? Maybe a little humbleness could do some good to myself and others. Wonderful. Andy Williams, that was really inspiring. Thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Marcus.
By the way, if you haven't come across them already, there are a number of exciting programs on Spacewatch Global. Space Cafe Web Talks, Space Cafe Radios, Local Space Cafes, Moriba's Vox Populi. Believe me, there is something for everyone. As always, details can be found on the mothership at spacewatch.global. Thanks for joining us today. I'm looking forward to next time. Bye-bye.